Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Today we spend the hour on food politics, the good food revolution, and the movements to build equitable and sustainable food systems. America's farm program has some fundamental flaws, according to reports from the Environmental Working Group. They've been subsidizing landowners rather than farmers or those who are most in need. They also tend to support farming practices that don't promote either the healthiest food or sustainability. But some smaller movements are emerging to change the practices, some in very unlikely places. We're joined now by Will Allen. He is the author of The Good Food Revolution. He's also the founder of Growing Power, a nonprofit dedicated to equitable and sustainable food. And he says, creating a just world, one food secure community at a time. Welcome, Will Allen. It's great to have you here with us in studio.
It's great to be here, Maria.
What I'd like to start with is how your own family history took you back to the farm.
Both my parents from South Carolina, and they were both involved in agriculture. My mother's family, as far back as 400 years, they were both sharecroppers. And, of course, that wasn't a very good profession. My father escaped, left sharecropping, and migrated during the Great Migration to the Washington, D.C. area back in the 30s. And then my mother, who was actually married to another person, migrated to Maryland also. So when my parents remarried, and myself and my brothers, we grew up growing our own food. About 95% of the food that we ate, we grew ourselves. I learned those skills at a very, very early age, kind of how to take care of yourself by being proactive and bringing your own food into your life, you know, which is much different than the kids today.
You actually talked about in your book the Great Migration and how it affected specifically African Americans in their own, for lack of a better word, empowerment.
One of the things that we see started to play out during that period of time is many of the skills about how to grow food pretty much stopped. It wasn't passed on. And farming is something that you pass on to the next generation. So that was something that really affected people's lives. And now we're starting to see the results of that in terms of the diseases, diabetes, high blood pressure, lack of a good food system, lack of access to food in communities today, and many young people not really knowing where their food came from, and their parents missed out. A couple generations really missed out on getting those skills, and those are life skills passed on to them.
The other thing you wrote about is relationship to the earth, that sense of self-dignity, being able to grow your own food.
Yeah, it's something that, again, wasn't passed on, and we're all kind of people of the earth, whether we want to admit it or not. You know, I think a lot of people have lost connection because back in the day, everybody had a family member, very close family member, that was involved in agriculture and growing food. So we've gotten away from that into this kind of centralized food system, industrial food system, where our food is coming from just a few places around the country. And matter of fact, only 1% of food in Milwaukee and most major cities like Detroit and Youngstown, Ohio, Buffalo, New York, less than 1% is locally grown today. But back in the 30s and 40s, a lot of the food that we ate was grown within those states. So we at least had regional food systems, but today we don't have that. So the work that we've been doing over these past years is really to resurrect that system. Everybody thinks of it as a new food system, but it's really about resurrecting a system that we already had, but doing it in a different kind of way and doing it with different people, not necessarily folks that grew up on farms, but young people that are in our colleges and in universities and our high schools and in programs, youth serving programs at nonprofits around the country.
I found it interesting, the juxtaposition of first your own family history, then becoming a professional ball player, then working in corporate America, but in the food industry, and then coming to this sort of homecoming back to the earth, back to the farm, and using that to really affect in a positive way people's health, the environment, the communities.
Right.
Can you make that connection?
When I left Maryland to go away to college, I had about 100 scholarship offers, decided to go to University of Miami. At that point in time, I said, I'll never do this farming again because I always had to be home early. We didn't have gas stoves and that sort of thing. We had wood stoves. I had to cut wood and that sort of thing. And my friends, I always thought my friends were having this great time out. I always had to be in early. As a matter of fact, my high school teammates used to tease me and call me in early because my father was very strict, and I go play games and I'm the big star, but I had to be home. So I said, I want to have some fun, you know. So when I left to go to college, I said to myself, I never want to do this kind of work again. And I think many rural farm kids say that same thing. But after college, went over to Europe to play basketball, and one of my teammates' family had a farm. And he asked me if I wanted to go out one day and on the farm. And I went out and I helped them plant some potatoes. And they did it the way that we did. They didn't have any tractors or anything. So we spaded up ground and planted. And the soil was very rich because Europeans are way ahead of us in terms of knowing about the soil and how important the soil is. And it's all about the soil is something I always say. So that was the transformative moment. I also found myself, I would take my wife and the kids out in the country, and I think they thought I was crazy, just looking at cows and stuff, you know. And we'd park and kind of look at the cows and look at the land. And all of a sudden, a strong desire to grow food again. And I actually started doing it. I got 25 chickens, and we had a garden. And Belgium's a small country, so I knew most of the players on the other teams, Americans. There were two Americans on each team in our league, and during Thanksgiving and Christmas, we'd have them over to our house, and my wife, Cindy, would fix this wonderful meal with some of the vegetables that we grow and have this big feast with all the American players and so forth. So here I was back doing the same things that my parents did and having people over at our house because we were known as the people that had all the food. And my parents' friends and my teammates and stuff would kind of congregate at our house because my mother loved to cook, and she would cook at any time. So she would cook enough food, I think, every meal for about 30 people. We were big people, you know, me being 6'7". And food was always a very important and powerful piece in our lives. And so now I'm doing pretty much the same thing, growing food, getting it to folks in all the communities around Milwaukee and Chicago and Madison.
So let's talk about how this developed. It seems to me that you looked at several different models, including like the community farming. And in some ways you found that to be really great, but in some ways you thought, well, poor people can't actually participate in that. Where did you go from?
Well, my whole thing has always been to be able to have everybody access the same good food, regardless of their economic situation. So I had to come up with some schemes to make that happen in terms of having a more integrative food system to grow 150 or more crops to be able to...
On a very small plot.
Well, yeah. I mean, I had lots of rural farming experience and some rural farms as well. But this idea of growing food in the city close to where people live and doing it in a way that you start looking at agriculture instead of acres or hectares, to look at it in terms of square footage. So that was part of the thing that we do, is to be able to grow food at $5 to $50 a square foot. At $5 a square foot, you're grossing about $200,000 an acre because there's 43,000 something square feet in an acre. So if you look at it that way, and to be able to get that food in different ways to in different communities, regardless, because I didn't want our food just to go to wealthy people, this good food, natural food grown without chemicals. So I had to come up with ways of getting it to low-income people at a reasonable price. And to be able to do that, some of the things that we came up with was the use of renewable energy in a whole bunch of different ways to cut the production cost, because that's what dictates the cost of our food. I believe that a lot of our organic food is artificially inflated because they're gearing that food for a particular audience. But if we're able to cut the production cost to be able to grow our own soil, because you need new soil if you're going to grow in a city because everything is contaminated, so we grow soil first. If you're not able to grow soil, you can't scale up to the point to be able to grow this healthy food. So cutting the production cost is really where it's at.
One of the philosophical parts that I alluded to in an earlier question about coming from the for-profit food industry and then moving into really a world of nonprofit natural food.
I come from a for-profit perspective. I didn't know much about nonprofit organizations. But once I bought that farm in 1993, and our first couple of years, we were a for-profit entity. And I helped a youth group who needed some help in starting an organic garden. And I gave them some land. And we got an article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And my friends said, since you like working with kids, you should start a nonprofit. And I said, I don't really know anything about nonprofit work. They came from the nonprofit arena, so they said, we'll be your first board and we'll do the administrative work, because I said, all I want to do is work with the kids and teach the kids about where their food came from and how to grow it and that sort of thing. Bringing what I had and the skill set that I had in terms of working for corporate companies really bodes well for us now, because you can't really sustain a nonprofit today without having some type of income other than writing grants or what I call begging for money. I think today you have to be kind of this social entrepreneurial organization to survive. Many nonprofits don't have that business skill set to survive the day. I see a lot of them scaling down instead of scaling up. And we've been able to scale up because we have over 40 income streams coming into Growing Power. And we do write some grants, but we have a very small grant department. And much of our income comes from fee-for-service and selling food.
Reminds me just a little bit, Food from the Hood.
Yeah, they've been around a long time when they were bottling their different products and so forth. So they're pretty famous for doing that, with the kids getting scholarships to college and that.
Were you watching the South Central Farms when they were here in Los Angeles?
Yeah, I think everybody in the country was very upset when they lost those farms, because that was a great project too. And that's part of what this is all about. We're also a land trust to try to secure land for agriculture over a long period of time, to put land in trust or to be able to purchase land so you can do this farming act. I go out and try to build the relationships to be able to secure land over a long period of time. Now, we've been able to purchase some land. Our headquarters is owned by Growing Power now,
which is your nonprofit.
Yeah, that's a great start. And we have long-term leases with the Milwaukee Public School System and corporate companies and folks that really like our mission and vision to the future about growing local food.
Growing local food, and then also you're engaging the kids at the schools.
I've seen a change in terms of what's happening at the schools, because now we're training teachers to do hands-on learning. When educators go to college, they get a lot of practical education out in the community and so forth. So now what we're doing is helping to train some of those teachers in how to grow food and how to build aquaponic systems to teach the kids, to get the kids engaged, and how to teach these kids how to prepare the food, you know, to cook the food. We're really attacking it from every angle you can possibly attack it from through our nonprofit.
Just a reminder that you are listening to the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. We've been speaking with Will Allen. He's the author of The Good Food Revolution and the founder of Growing Power. Let's turn to the soil. You said you had to grow the soil because urban soil tends to have been destroyed by fertilizers and such. And you've talked about in your book a whole section about what that takes. Can you talk about this transition all the way to Growing Power that had impacts? One was the worm revolution. And then there was the actual Growing Power revolution.
Yeah. Well, when I grew up, we grew soil ourselves. We had chickens, so the waste from the chickens we'd compost, and that's what we'd use for fertilizer because we couldn't afford to buy commercial fertilizer. And at that time, coming out of the Second World War is when we started using all the commercial fertilizer and all the pesticides and herbicides and so forth. And that's continued, and that's what really fueled these large industrial farms, the use of chemicals and technology around GMO foods and that sort of thing. But folks today, these generations, we don't know very much about the food that we eat every day. And it's really important to know about the food you eat, and because most people don't know, it's all about the soil. If you're going to eat organic or natural foods, you have to grow new soil, because our soil is contaminated. We've contaminated our soil, not only in urban areas, but in suburban areas with all the lawn spraying and all the chemicals we've used. And, of course, in the rural communities, because of how industrial agriculture has gotten almost completely away from, on large farms, away from growing natural food and using GMO seeds and spraying with Roundup and that sort of thing. So it's so important to be able to grow new soil, and that's what we do, because healthy soil, you should have 30 worms in every square foot of soil. We wouldn't have to do anything to the soil if we had that condition, but we don't have that condition. So we have to manufacture new soil. And to do that, we take the waste that goes in a landfill, food waste and carbon waste, and we compost that and grow soil, and we use that to grow the food. So we don't have any digging equipment. When we grow in the city, we put 2 feet of new soil on top of the existing soil or on top of asphalt or concrete or rooftops, and we grow food in it. And that's what we have to do. We have to grow new soil. And that's one of the toughest things to do.
You can put that on asphalt?
Yes, we grow on asphalt and concrete. A lot of our farms. So when I go in the cities and I look for places to grow, I don't necessarily look for green grass.
So you don't necessarily break up the concrete either?
No.
And get rid of it?
No, because below the concrete...
You just put the soil on top of it.
Right. Below the concrete may be a lot of contaminants. And we've had tissue samples of our crops, and we've never come up with any kind of contaminants being taken up when we use this soil. Now, the other important thing is that we incorporate worms. We have worm nurseries, large worm nurseries. We grow worms. We started with 30 pounds of worms. We have over 7,000 pounds of worms on one farm. And we inject worms into all of our compost. So it's living soil. And that's what a lot of people really need to do, is to be really grow in living soil. Those microorganisms tickle the root fibers, and that's what makes food grow, and that's what makes food taste good. Because it's all about the soil. If you have healthy soil, the food tastes so much different than when you don't have the right micronutrients in the soil.
Which then, of course, contributes to having healthy people.
Right. Because much of the food that's shipped from, say, and I don't want to pick on, because I'm out here in California, pick on the California, but when food is shipped from California, from Salinas into Milwaukee or New York, it takes about 3 days. It may stay out here in the warehouses a couple of days. Now you're talking about 5 days, and it goes to the wholesalers. It may stay a couple more days, and then the grocery stores put it on the shelf, and we go in and buy it. And when you go in the grocery store today, they do such a great job with all the lights, you know, the different colored lights and the misters and everything. But nobody in that store is going to tell you how old that food is, unless you buy something like strawberries and they have a date on it or something like that. But most of the vegetables, you have no idea how old they are. So a lot of times we're eating food that's 8 or 9 days old, and it's lost 50% of its nutrients in half cellulose. Regardless of whether we buy it at a very high-end store, it's the same thing. It doesn't matter whether it's at a high-end store, you buy it from some lower-end store, it still travels those miles, and it's lost a lot of its impact. Best case scenario is to grow it in your backyard or side yard and eat it the same day you pick it, and you eat it the same day.
If you can beat the squirrels.
Well, there's ways of getting around that, too.
Yeah, oh, do tell.
There are ways of getting around the animals and the pests and so forth. But it's really important, a local food system, to get that food in our bellies within a day, day and a half of production versus 8, 9, 10 days. So it used to be that way, and we need to go back to those days. Realistically, we're not going to get all of our food from a local food system, but we should be able to walk into a grocery store, walk in and look at the produce aisle and have a locally grown section. And not have to search, because today you really have to search for locally grown labels and stores, and, you know, you get frustrated.
If you were to imagine your vision of what you ultimately would like to see done and the impact that you'd like to have on youth, on communities, on health, on the environment, how would you articulate the vision and the impact?
The vision piece, we're a long way from really getting there. We have to quantify a lot of things, because a lot of people, there's a tremendous amount of excitement. That's why it's gone from a movement to a revolution. Every city I go to, large crowds. Of course, Michael Pollan has written so much about it, and Eric Schlosser, and many other books, and there's so many documentaries. So the excitement's there, but we have to quantify so many things. We have to quantify that you can actually cash flow these small farms in cities. We have to quantify things like aquaculture, taking these vacant buildings and doing fish systems, because 50% of our fish is farm grown. It's going to go to 75%. So it's tremendous opportunity for folks to be able to grow fish as a protein source. But we have to quantify and figure out the types of systems that they need to grow these fish in and how to grow the fish and be able to train people, because this kind of agriculture is about square footage and being able to use every bit of space, because this is high-valued space inside cities, inside greenhouses. So there's so much work to be done. What we're trying to do at Growing Power is to quantify that you can change the dynamics. I believe in the next several years we'll go from 1% to 10% in local food production. That's just our organization doing that. So if we can get other organizations to chime in, we can get a larger percentage of locally grown food. Because right now, if everybody said they wanted to eat healthy food, we don't have enough in this city or any other city to really eat healthy food grown without chemicals. So we need to scale that up. The talk is great, but we really need to get to work. The exciting part is we have all these young people, over 75% are under 40 now, that want to do this. And we have older people that are leaving professions, even doctors and lawyers, that come to our trainings every month. They want to leave the profession. And we have more people of color since the First Lady put the garden on the White House lawn. They said 10 million new people started growing food, many of them people of color who 15 years ago would tell me, Will, why are you doing this work? It's slave's work. I don't hear that anymore. So we've seen that transformation take place. The folks that grew food under duress and slavery and sharecropping want to go back to growing food again because they've been educated and their health is gone south and obesity rates are at an all-time high. Our country is at its all-time low point in terms of our health. We need to do this to survive.
You were talking about, you know, getting people out there to actually do this and affect the change, and it reminded me of a section in your book where you talked about a do tank instead of a think tank.
We can sit around a table and plan, and I'm not against planning because we do project planning, but we do project planning to launch people into action. Because, like I said, we can sit around a table for 2 or 3 years, we can get planning grants. I used to get really pissed off because I'd see these organizations get these planning grants and they would sit around for 2-3 years and talk about doing something. And once the grant was over, everybody scattered to the hills and nothing got done. Meanwhile, we're struggling for dollars just to get some land or tools or whatever. And we were just doing stuff, you know. It might have not been perfect because you can never, I think a lot of times when we plan things, we're waiting for that perfect moment to get started. There is never a perfect moment. So my thing is, let's get started. Let's learn, because farming is something you learn not in a classroom, but in a hands-on way. Let's go out and learn how to deal with these conditions that we're dealt with in the cities or wherever and tweak it along the way. But let's go out and do something.
Finally, in terms of policies that would be supportive of this kind of food, farming, earth, environment, community, have you started to see those come into existence?
Absolutely. Recently, I was in Boston. The mayor of Boston and the zoning department invited me in to launch their effort to change policy on growing food in the city of Boston, because they had no policy. So in some ways, it was illegal, even though there were groups growing, youth groups like the Food Project in Boston and others that were growing food, but it was really illegal. And they wanted to come up with some policies. And this was really being pushed by the city, which was highly unusual because it's usually pushed by community groups. As a matter of fact, a couple of community groups that were pushing back, saying, why is the city wanting to create a policy? They thought it was some sinister move by the city. But in fact, the mayor of Boston and the zoning department was seeing what was happening around the country in other cities like Milwaukee. They didn't want to be left behind. They wanted agricultural zoning in all three areas, residential, industrial, and commercial, like we have in Milwaukee. So I've seen that change. But the reason that that has changed is because of concrete projects, not because folks have gone to City Hall and lobbied and so forth, stood in a line, or gone to D.C. and stood in a line and tried to lobby for that. I think what we've done in Milwaukee is have this concrete project that we can bring policymakers out and show them that this is something that'll benefit the city, that this becomes an asset to the city. And the fact that we brought in a national conference every year for the last 7 years to the tune of about $15 million to the city. And those are their numbers to the city of Milwaukee. Then you start being looked at as an asset. So you get the mayor, you get the city council, you get everybody on board, and they want to see urban agriculture grow because they look at it as an asset. In the local community, it has to start with the local community. As the first thing we did was to engage the local community, so we have them on board at the very beginning many years ago.
Well, thank you so much, Will Allen. Again, the book is called The Good Food Revolution, Growing Healthy Food, People, and Communities. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Maria.
When we come back, how to build a sustainable and equitable food system. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Our next two guests have studied the food system and what it means to have a system that is equitable and sustainable. What are the problems in the system and what are the solutions? With us is Raj Patel. He is a research professor in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System, The Value of Nothing, and The History of the World and Seven Cheap Things. He also co-hosts a fortnightly food politics podcast, The Secret Ingredient. Saru Jayaraman is also with us. She's the co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Center United and the director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. Her books include The Accidental American, Behind the Kitchen Door, and Forked, A New Standard for American Dining. Raj Patel and Saru Jayaraman are contributors to The Nation magazine's special issue, The Future of Food, Setting the Table for the Next Generation.
So welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you here with us. You guys have done a special issue for The Nation magazine about just sustainable food systems. I thought we should start with what we're talking about. When we say just sustainable food systems, Raj Patel, what does that mean for you?
I think we're all sort of agreed that in order for something to be sustainable, it needs to be more than just a process of being able to get the food out of the ground reliably season after season. For it to be sustainable, we need to be talking both about ecological and social sustainability. You can't continue harvesting as we have while dependent on carbon being spewed into the atmosphere, destroying the possibility of future generations from being able to grow food. But similarly, you can't depend, as the food system does, on the exploitation of workers from farm to fork in order to be able to get your organic and locally grown food. So sustainability is necessarily both a social and an ecological term.
So then necessarily connected with a just food system.
That's right. So the idea of justice is, I think, one that's incredibly wide, right? I mean, when we think about justice, we need to be thinking not just about our present generation, as Saru's work just shows so magnificently, you know, treating workers properly right now, but also thinking about future generations, about what's fair to as yet unborn generations, but also thinking about the past, about atoning for the way that the food system now is built on centuries of slavery and colonialism.
Well, that's a perfect lead-in for Saru. Saru, why don't you tie history into this present day and where we are today as a result of this, how they're all connected?
You know, the existence of the food system in America relies on the labor of 20 million workers. One in six American workers works in food. It is by far the largest, collectively the largest private sector employment in the United States. And yet it is the lowest paying. And in particular, within that group of 20 million, the vast majority, 12 million of those workers are restaurant workers. alone, forget the rest of the food system, alone the restaurant industry is the second largest and absolute fastest growing sector of the U.S. economy. And yet it is actually the restaurant industry is the absolute lowest paying employer in the U.S. Every year, the Department of Labor puts out a list of the 10 lowest paying jobs, and 7 of the 10 are restaurant jobs. And we've discovered that that really is due to the money, power, and influence of a trade lobby called the National Restaurant Association, which represents the Fortune 500 chains, and which, as it turns out, if you look back in history, really it's the predecessor forms of this trade lobby fought to be able to hire newly freed slaves post-emancipation and pay them a $0 wage and let them live on customer tips. And that idea was actually codified into law so that the first tipped workers in the United States were mostly Black. They were actually given a $0 wage from their employer and made to live on tips. And we went from a $0 wage in 1938 to a whopping $2.13 an hour, the current federal minimum wage for tipped workers in the U.S. And it's between $2.13 and $7.50 in 43 states in the United States. It's an abysmal, a ridiculous wage that it forces a mostly female workforce to live off tips and really, tolerate the absolute worst sexual harassment of any industry because they're having to feed their families on tips. These are not young workers. They're mostly in their mid-30s. 40% of them are single moms, and they're having to feed their families on the whims of customers who often mistreat them in various ways because they know they have that power. So really, when we talk about a just and sustainable food system, I think I would say two things. One, you cannot have sustainable food without sustainable wages and working conditions for the people who cook, prepare, and serve that food. And certainly, once we know that that whole system is a legacy of slavery and a source of sexual harassment, I don't understand how we could have a sustainable restaurant as we do in America, sustainable food restaurant that pays its workers $2 and $3 an hour. But that is a very common thing. Some of our favorite organic, local, and sustainable food restaurants pay $2 and $3 to their workers. But the second thing I really have to say is sustainable has another meaning to it, which is that sustainable means sustained, that it can go on, it can continue. And when 1 in 3 Americans at this moment works full-time or more than full-time and lives in poverty, and we're heading to, within 10 years, a moment in which 1 in 2 working Americans will work full-time and live in poverty. You cannot sustain any food system when half of the country cannot afford to eat or eat out, let alone have a sustainable food system sustained. So I don't know if that made sense, but there's just no way for this system to continue as it's continuing right now, unless we address the wages and working conditions of workers in the food system.
I wonder, before we go on to other types of food workers, and Raj, you wrote about some of these in your piece, particularly the banana workers. Saru, have you looked at the United States treatment of its restaurant workers, food workers, compared to other countries in similar situations? Is it unique in how poorly it treats its restaurant staff, for example?
Certainly, labor exploitation is not unique to the United States, but it must be understood that we quite often set the standards for the world. And particularly with the chains that are mostly based here and have formed this thing called the National Restaurant Association and have lately formed something called the Multinational Hospitality and Restaurant Association, the MHRA. And this idea of paying workers this ridiculously low wage definitely is a result of our unique racial caste system in the United States, of our legacy of slavery. And that now the MHRA is working actively to spread this idea of a lower wage for tipped workers in many other countries. They've been fighting for it in Canada. They've been fighting for it in other parts of the world. So we're not unique in the exploitation of food workers. We are unique in the sense that we set the standards, and certainly the major corporations that are driving this exploitation worldwide are based here and have won kind of these ridiculous wage agreements here and are trying to push that on the rest of the world.
Raj, you noted in your piece in The Nation about the other end of this, which is the production and what happened to banana workers in Central America, for example. Tell us how that ties into sustainable food systems and just food systems.
The idea here is that, for example, people are buying fair trade coffee and fair trade tea and fair trade bananas. And the idea there is that when you're buying fair trade, what you're doing is you hope giving workers just a little bit more, or giving farmers rather, a little bit more so that they can survive the very low commodity prices that are being imposed on them by these big multinationals. And so I buy fair trade coffee because, you know, what's the alternative? You know, bastard coffee, the kind of coffee that involves the exploitation of children because I like my coffee bitter. No, you buy fair trade. But the problem is not in the idea that people oughtn't to be able to survive. The problem is twofold. On the one hand, this is a very unilateral move. It's a sort of pennies, you know, sort of crumbs from the table from us, a sort of small token of recognition that we feel a little bit guilty that people are in general in conditions of extreme exploitation. But the deeper problem is that we never stop to think about why it is that large parts of Central America are the United States fruit bowl. How is it that we're okay with the conversion of land in large parts of the world to suit us? And you know, some people say, well, you know, what, if we don't buy their bananas, what will they do? Poor things. And of course, that's an utterly rubbish argument. I mean, it's to paper over the fact that it took violence and state power from the United States to make it possible for the United Fruit Company, a company that was known locally as El Pulpo, the octopus, for its tentacles into various sort of houses of power, to be able to establish itself in the Caribbean. And you know, today we have the vestiges of that history when we think about terms like banana republic. You know, when we say that some places are banana republic, what we sometimes mean is the idea that you know, although it has the nominal sort of view of being a democracy, in fact, you know, it's a general who's in charge and he's our man and he's, you know, he's a company man. And the idea of banana republics emerges because the United Fruit Company paid and made sure that the kinds of people who are in charge of these countries are ones who didn't want things like land reform. And so when a democratically elected president started to find that there were some bits of the banana plantations that weren't being used, and he said, look, we'll buy them from you and we'll redistribute them to the poor, the United Fruit Company was so alarmed that they called John Foster Dulles at the CIA, and the CIA ignited a coup that then resulted in a civil war in which 250,000 people were killed. That you don't get from fair trade. Acknowledging that history, you don't get from fair trade. And that, as I was saying, right now the US is pushing these heinous trade agreements on other countries. Before, the US has been doing similar things by just forcing US companies on and US governance on large parts of the Caribbean. And that question is a much trickier one to address when we think about the US culpability here, because really the answer is that we ought to be paying the countries that we have in many ways turned to our convenience and in the process killed hundreds of thousands. We ought to be paying reparation.
You mentioned the trade agreements right now and how harmful they are. Given what the United States has now with Donald Trump at the helm trying to or promising to dismantle these trade agreements, is that something that should be done?
If you're asking me, Maria, I think absolutely that the international peasant movement, La Via Campesina, is very keen on taking agriculture out of the World Trade Organization and out of NAFTA. NAFTA was explicitly aimed at kicking Mexican peasants off their land so that large-scale agriculture could produce cheap food to then sell to the United States. But removing, you know, the U.S. from NAFTA does nothing to redistribute the land that was taken from these peasants. So, you know, without that concomitant kind of redistribution of land back to the poor, getting out of a trade agreement, and particularly the way that Trump's going to do it, is a half measure that has the possibility of leaving poor people worse off. I certainly think it's a good idea for countries to be able to have sovereignty in a way that trade agreements deny them. But the way that Trump is doing it, of course, is as part of a sort of xenophobic plan, not to be able to redistribute goods to the poor, but in order for the richest corporations in this country to be able to have their way on new and newly renegotiated terms.
So much of what the two of you are talking about really ties back into these very large publicly traded corporations and the power that they have. So then the question becomes, you know, how do you deal with these really large international, multinational corporations that wield so much power? Saru, what do you think?
Yeah. Well, you fight them. You know, like, we are an organization that has been up against one of the most powerful trade lobbies, I would say, in the world, the National Restaurant Association. It's been named one of the top 10 lobbying groups in Congress. We call it the other NRA because most people know about the Rifle Association, but just don't know how powerful the Restaurant Association is on a lot of different issues. And, you know, we're not a huge group. We started as a little scrappy group just 15 years ago, and over the last 15 years have organized and fought and exposed them in so many ways that they have felt threatened enough to attack us. So, I mean, they've spent at this point over $10 million trying to shut us down, from lawsuits to congressional investigations, going after our funders, going after our tax exempt status, going after me personally, putting my children's pictures up on their attack website. I mean, they will do anything to stop workers from demanding their rights or asking for more than the $2 and $3 that they are lobbying. You know, they've lobbied so well to keep wages at. And so we need to expose trade lobbies and huge corporations and their activities. We need to fight against them. And we really, mostly, especially need to be holding accountable elected officials in both parties that have rolled over to really facilitate the power of these huge corporations. You know, unfortunately, in our case, we've seen elected officials in both parties kowtow to the Restaurant Association because they fund their campaigns and because they know they'll attack hard if they don't do everything that they want. And so we, the people, need to be showing our support to electeds that stand up to the Restaurant Association and Big Ag and large corporations, and also holding accountable any electeds that don't do that. And that's the only way that we're going to actually have a true democracy rather than a nation controlled completely by corporate kleptocrats.
Raj Patel, what would you say to that?
I mean, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, we have, as we record now, the storm breaking about Harvey Weinstein, for example. And, you know, one of the things that Saru's research has shown is the way in which, the structure of low wages and tipped work and the forum of the restaurant as it is, it is the perfect cocktail for sexual assaults to be happening. For elected officials to be condoning that, the enabling environment of a million Harvey Weinsteins, is the sort of shame that we ought to be bringing to their door right now.
Yeah, I imagine that's tough, given that the president of the United States is, for lack of a better term, the groper in chief.
But I do think that while perhaps our president cannot feel the emotion of shame, that there are ways in which the elected officials who side with the National Restaurant Association can be made to pay a very high political cost.
And I just want to chime in that the reason we have a president who's a groper in chief is because you have millions of working people across America that feel completely disgusted, disillusioned, and disengaged with the political system precisely because they see elected officials rolling over to corporate interests. So so many people talk about, people voted for Trump. I mean, the truth everybody knows is most people in America did not vote in this election. And it was like the lowest turnout ever. And I know from our population of 12 million restaurant workers, it's because they feel just totally turned off by the powers that be and the way in which they kowtow to the Restaurant Association. So rather, there's such an inclination, among elites, I would say even in the food movement, in quotes, to want to be somewhat centrist and not be too bold or too progressive. And I actually think that is the wrong intuition. The intuition should be, we should be listening, especially to working people in this moment that income inequality has reached its climax, its zenith in the United States. We need to be listening to working people and showing them that we will deliver for them in order to not have a Trump get elected. And that's what we haven't done. And I do want to bring up one thing that I brought up in the Nation piece that's a really good example of how the National Restaurant Association is now wielding its power and what working people can do and everybody can do. You know, the Restaurant Association has gotten together with President Trump and his Department of Labor to announce new proposed regulation that's already been submitted to the White House that any restaurant that pays a worker a full minimum wage in this country, that's $7.25 an hour, gets to wholly and legally steal its workers' tips, keep its workers' tips. Meaning a restaurant can charge you, give you a bill and you pay a tip and you think it's going to the worker, but now legally with Trump's new rule, the boss can take that tip that you gave, thinking it's going to the workers, and go buy a Mercedes. I mean, that is what is being proposed. It's going to be submitted for to the White House for review. It will come up for public comment later this year, early next year. It's already been made law in the 10th Circuit. It is outrageous. It should outrage anybody. You know, it overturns 80 years of law saying that tips are the property of workers. It should outrage workers, of course, but it should outrage consumers because it's consumer fraud. And it's just another example of collusion between corporate America and just complete control of our democracy. And so we need people to stand up and speak out and say, absolutely not. We don't want our tips going to the boss. And that is, again, Democrats or others who stand up and say that is wrong, I think will find that they are going to have a lot more support than those that just roll over and let the Restaurant Association or other corporations do their bidding.
In some of the jurisdictions in the U.S. where you've seen the minimum wage go up to, say, $15 an hour, and I think there have been a handful of those, have they included restaurant workers in this or have they excluded them?
Only 7 states have included restaurant workers. California, Oregon, Washington, Nevada, Minnesota, Montana, and Alaska got rid of this legacy of slavery, this lower wage for tipped workers. In California, it's been 50 years since they got rid of this. In the other 43 states, including New York and Washington, D.C. and Massachusetts, every time the wage has gone up, including the new efforts to go to 15. So in New York and D.C., 15 was passed. But in all of those states, tipped workers were left out or even saw their workers decline. Their wages decline. And so what you essentially have is legislation that raises wages for everybody except the poorest women in the state. They're throwing the poorest women under the bus every time they raise the minimum wage. And again, it's due to the power of the Restaurant Association and its control even over Democrats who move these minimum wage bills, who then the Democrats, we need to give the Restaurant Association its exemption so that their workers are not covered by this $15. And that is precisely why we as people need to be holding those elected officials accountable.
With regards to the future of food, what is it we're facing with farming, ownership, diseases that are happening on the farms, climate that is making food security heightened? What are we facing in terms of food sustainability?
If we're thinking just in terms of climate change, then we're already heading towards a rather perilous situation in which productivity is destined to fall in the United States. And that's without even thinking about the rise of certain kinds of weed resistance and the certain kinds of transformations in U.S. ecology that makes it inevitable that farms will be less productive here. But of course, the people who are worst hit by this are the people who have nothing to do with climate change. If you look at the sort of map of the most vulnerable populations around the world, it's folk in sub-Saharan Africa, in Southeast Asia and South Asia, whose contribution to climate change has been utterly minimal, and who will nonetheless be the climate refugees, and climate refugees have already started to cross borders, but who will be the people who suffer the hardest while we are relatively insulated with the wealth that we've accumulated through centuries of being able to burn as much carbon as we like. So the long-term outlook in terms of climate alone is one that bends towards injustice. And again, you know, that will mean to some extent food price hikes, and that will ripple through the United States because, as Saru was saying, with so many people in the United States already food insecure, we're at 50 million at the moment, and with so many people who are working poor in the United States, the inequalities that climate change is already foisting on the world and which will be felt much worse outside this country will also be felt here. And again, it's through the structure of social inequality in the United States that the horrors of climate change will be magnified and unequally distributed. And one could say the same thing about the dangerous state of meat production, for example. And another thing that's happening in the Trump administration is that the National Chicken Council is looking to speed up line speeds for workers who are involved in chicken processing. to raise the number of chickens passing inspectors to, 160, 180 birds per minute. And it's almost certain that at those higher speeds, as we've seen in other parts of the world, when you increase line speeds that way, diseases thrive and pass inspectors by. And that doesn't augur well for the food system either. And again, you know, the diseases that propagate through the food system are made worse by the kinds of things that the Restaurant Opportunity Center has observed, where, you know, if you're being paid very little, you have no healthcare, and you have to work, then you'll go to work even if you're sick, and you'll go to work if you're sick with H1N1. And again, the food system becomes a more dangerous and toxic place because of the inequality foisted by these large corporations.
You had also said at another interview about the sixth extinction we're all facing, that it's human demand for meat that's really driving a lot of this extinction. Can you tie that together for us?
Sure. Let's take the example of chicken. The original chicken, it comes from Southeast Asia, from the jungles of Southeast Asia. That bird and the indigenous people used to rely on it have been not rendered extinct, but 50% of the original chicken species are now extinct. Instead, we have government breeding programs that now have chickens that are bred with breasts that are so large that they can't walk. In order to be able to fund and feed these animals, large parts of the world fall under the plow. And so that means the Brazilian Cerrado, a very dynamic ecosystem, gets converted into monocultural soy farming. And when you clear these habitats and you replace it by monoculture, you render species extinct. The demand for meat, again, is linked and requires fuel and investment and the transformation of large parts of the planet's surface. And the industrialization, the industrial meat production system, requires that there are just two or three species that interact that bring us our whatever it is. And the consequence of that is that there's less and less room on the planet for biodiversity. And so certainly the consumption of meat is very much linked to transformations in habitat. And certainly the industrial massive sort of meatification of the world's diet is linked to species extinction in a very deep way.
You know, the last thing I would like to cover has to do with the automation of both the farming industry and the food service industry. So I happened to notice a restaurant when I was in Washington, D.C., in which there were no food workers, in which you go in and you press some buttons and you order your food and a machine prepares it and you look up on the wall and it tells you which slot from which you pull your food out. Similarly, there was one in the airport, it might have been Athens, in which similarly, no food workers. They set up iPads, you order your food through the iPad, you say what to hold, what you want, you pay through the iPad, and that's done. There was an article in a newspaper recently in which farms are now being automated to that degree. What do we see in our future here? Saru, why don't you start on that?
This is a favorite argument of the National Restaurant Association. They love to say that if you raise wages, we'll just automate, you know, everything and replace restaurant workers with robots. And in the restaurant industry, at least, which, as I mentioned, is the largest and fastest growing sector of the food system, but also the second largest and absolute fastest growing sector of the entire U.S. economy, that is simply not true. Automation is not replacing jobs in the restaurant industry. In fact, the regions where we've seen the greatest automation in the restaurant industry, we've seen actually the fastest job growth. So in our industry, people generally actually go to restaurants because they want to be served by human beings. And it has not actually happened that automation has replaced jobs. In many ways, actually, automation has actually just increased jobs because the restaurants that are not automated continue to have workers. And then the automated restaurants, nobody's actually fully automated. There are always workers involved somehow in an automated restaurant. And so those are additional jobs. So our industry just continues to explode. There's absolutely no indication that that will decline anytime soon. And what that points to is the fact that what we really need is to increase wages. The industry is actually going through the worst labor shortage in the history of the industry because workers simply cannot afford to stay in one place. Employers are dying to find, attract, and retain workers. And so they're having to figure out that we have so many high road restaurants that have joined our association and they're calling for higher wages in the industry because everybody on the leading edge of the industry is beginning to realize this business model is just not sustainable. We can't keep workers. And really, again, the future of the food system depends on changing this business model so that the industry can continue and, frankly, the nation's economy can survive. And that there is a food system, because there won't be when half, as I said, half the country can't afford to eat.
Raj Patel, anything you would add to that?
Well, I mean, the stretch for automation in the fields is sort of the extension of the transformation of farmers as botanists and as experimenters into farmers as technical kind of chemistry managers and robot maintainers. It involves, to some extent, the de-skilling of what it is to be nurturing life and to be connected to life, and instead a transformation towards turning fields into these fully automated factories. I think that particularly if we're interested in surviving the sixth extinction and the surviving climate change, what we need is diversification. And the knowledge of people who are tending these living beings in the fields needs to be recognized, and the wages there need to be raised as well. So rather than solve the labor shortage that we're seeing also in the fields right now, and again, this is a sort of a corollary of the sort of Trump immigration issues, but the labor shortages in the fields are being purported at some level to be solved by bringing robots into the fields. But all you're doing is consolidating a monocultural agricultural system that can't survive, just can't survive, as we're seeing with these extreme weather events around the country. Monocultures are really bad at surviving extreme weather events, but diversified farming systems are much better. Diversified farming systems require skill and labor, and well-paid labor at that. And moving away from the disaster of monoculture towards a system that recognizes and values skilled labor, I think, is tremendously important. But to fight that, you have to fight the chemistry industry. And that's a story for another time.
Let me thank you both for your time, for your research, and for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Raj Patel is a research professor in the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System, The Value of Nothing, and The History of the World and Seven Cheap Things. He also co-hosts a fortnightly food politics podcast, The Secret Ingredient. Saru Jayaraman is the co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Center United and the director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley. Her books include The Accidental American, Behind the Kitchen Door, and Forked, A New Standard for American Dining. Raj Patel and Saru Jayaraman are contributors to The Nation magazine's special issue, The Future of Food, Setting the Table for the Next Generation.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible.
To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin,
Anais Amin,
Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.